Peter Max is a graphic artist who aspires to do visually what the Beatles have done for music. Whether he has succeeded or not may depend upon your age and taste in art. But one thing is certain, the products of his lively imagination are as ubiquitous as advertising. They show up in fabrics, household products, package design, neckties, car cards, and even the Manhattan telephone directory. As a consequence, Peter Max has not only become a pop culture hero to the young, he has become what some have described as a hippie millionaire, a curious combination of successful businessman and oriental mystic.
Peter, there's almost no place you can go in this world where you aren't confronted, whether you wish to or not, with something that's a product of your own imagination. It's really very widespread, as you know. You said at one time, it's not me covering the world, it's some great cosmic force. What is that cosmic force?
I think it's the life within me that I experience from moment to moment. That's what it is. Feeling life, being here, and letting it happen as it happens, letting it actually come out the moment it's coming out, not working up towards a mood, but being the mood. Being the mood of that moment. Being it, not working with it or around it, but actually going through it, not trying to bypass it.
How does this force manifest itself?
It's life. It's the same thing. It's like intuition. You know, when you have intuition, when you walk down the street, you see something nice, or you fall in love, or you are in a meadow and you see beautiful flowers and you get inspiration. And so same moods that go through me just standing in front of a canvas or in front of a concept. And I just become that, and then I articulate it and make it happen and dispatch my ideas to assist.
Does it go through you because you're Peter Max, or could it go through me as well?
I think it's there all the time. We as individuals pick it all up. It's whatever's coming through me is available for you, and whatever's coming through you is available to me, except I think our individualities, according to who we are, pick it up differently. We're all the same. There's one God, and we all are aspects of that variety. There's many varieties. But as an individual, we also have the individual qualities. All the varieties are made up of a lot of individual aspects. So we choose individually to take that part in and bring it
out.
Well,
you were saying earlier that you you have the capacity of receiving your ideas almost as a complete unit. Yeah. That it's not just a part of an idea, but you're able to dispatch people to do the work that needs done, growing out of this single idea. That seems to me to be fairly unusual. Most of us, I think, tend to think only in parts of an idea and go to experts in other areas to do the rest of it.
Well, I live with it, so it's not unusual to me. But I can walk into a room, a big hall. It could be a concert hall. It could be Radio City Music Hall. If they would ask me to, let's say, redo it, the ideas would start flowing, and I could dispatch my ideas to a number of people writing ideas, and most probably there'll be not a corner that I haven't covered. I'll cover every side, which will go from the color combinations to what has to be done first and second and third, you know, having production in mind, to the promotional repercussions of it. It's just an understanding. It's really understanding the media. Suppose, let's say, an artist during the turn of the century or before had an idea, so he knew where to get his paper, he knew where to get his paint, what to grind up, and where to set up his easel. Today, living in the 20th century, all the paints and all the easels are all there. So if I have an idea that entails something larger than my canvas, something that's in 3D, like an environment, like Times Square area or the Grand Canyon or something, it's the same concept, except while it doesn't end on the canvas, it ends out there. So the ideas come fully equipped.
Well, you're going to do, you mentioned Times Square and the Grand Canyon. I don't know about the Grand Canyon, but you are going to do something about Times Square.
Yes.
Now, this goes way beyond what I think of as a canvas.
Yes.
It requires, I should think, a knowledge of a great many fields,
yes,
which you are not particularly well-trained. What are you going to do with Times Square?
Well, I'm trying to do the best in renovating Times Square, to turn it from dark to light. Fortunately, I got involved in the purchase of the Allied Chemical Building with Alex Parker. I came up with a concept of taking a building.
This is the old building on which the ball drops on New Year's Eve.
Right.
For those who don't live in New York and may not recognize the Allied Chemical Building.
Yeah.
It's right at the point.
Crossroads of the world.
Yes.
And then in the center of the building is this long well, they call it, that has this long picture. Anyhow, and a new sign goes around. That building is mine as a piece of kinetic art, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's mine to express myself artistically, but reasonably, logically, and in the time and space of today. It's not something to do a pie in the sky idea with. This is to deal, it's a Times Square building that deals with Times Square. So we will set an example in Times Square as what should happen in Times Square. Mm-hmm. Already, Lindsay offered us 26 billboards to redo. And there are all these various other manifestations that go down the avenue.
Mm-hmm. Will it be done in what I suppose many people come to think of as the Peter Max style, the kind of up, joyous, Art Nouveau drawing that you've done in the past?
Not really. It'll be up and joyous, but it will not necessarily be represented in drawings that are joyous. In other words, my flying cosmic characters. They might not appear anywhere in the building. But the concepts are of a very large magnitude.
We have some of those flying characters that I might take a look at for, if there's anybody, I can't believe there is, anybody who's not acquainted with what we're talking about in connection with what I think of as the Peter Max style.
Right.
But how do you describe it?
Well, it's my, let me just say this. First of all, throughout my last 5-10 years, it's really a surrealistic type of art that I do. And these flying cosmic characters that fly in and out of rainbows and out of skies and that smile in blue and boats with reflection is very surrealistic, except it's a very up surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
Surrealism tends to get very weird sometimes. So I'm you know, if sometimes you see a painting of surrealism, let's say by Dali, and there's this big streak of light coming from the clouds, if you were going to open it with a little razor blade and peek in there, I might be in there doing all those colorful kind of things. But it is surrealism, but because I somehow was able to manifest this art form really down into the butter dishes and into the bed sheets and towels of the people, it now came out of surrealism into realism. They lived with it every day.
I see.
So it's a very strange phenomenon. I personally had experience because it is surrealism that I love.
Let me ask you about your life, because one would think, in looking back upon it, it doesn't reflect what you've just said. You were born in Berlin, as a matter of fact, and your family left Berlin when you were fairly young, did they not, and went to Shanghai. And they fled because of the Nazis. Now, this is not, it may be surrealistic, but it's hardly up.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I guess I've had my down, and now it's time for something up. I mean, life comes in, you know, in blocks of darknesses and light. My parents did have a hard time leaving Germany, but actually when we arrived in China, I grew up in a world that, I mean, looking back now, I really am very thankful for his grace of putting me through that. Because,
why?
Well, 12 years for somebody who maybe was originally artistic, as I always, this is my life, to grow up in a culture that's 8,000 years old, where every scent in the street and every move of everybody and all the gestures of the people and all the colors and the melodies are so sophisticated and they're so well balanced, and they already went through the yin and yang and what's good and what's evil, and it's all a romantic life, you know, painted according to Confucius or the I Ching or whatever, King Wen. So there I was, you know, 3 months old, growing up in all of this. And so even though finally after China, we went all around Africa and in Israel and finally came to America, this
body... How long was this Africa and Israel?
Four more years.
4 years.
Four more
so
years
had a
of...
considerable impact upon
yes,
your
really,
connection.
Really interesting. But so here, you know, even though at first view, you know, there's a Caucasian body. There's a lot of culture that's Oriental inside. In other words, I have an instinctive reaction to the smell of incense, mm-hmm. or to seeing a Swami, or to seeing the Hare Krishna people mm-hmm. in the street. I know very deeply what that is about, and mm-hmm. I love it. I love it.
Now, your schooling in Shanghai was not in a Chinese school, obviously.
No.
And your father was a rather well-to-do merchant, was he not?
Yes.
So that your contact with this was peripheral to your life rather than central to it, I assume.
The Chinese?
The Chinese.
Well, living in China, you know, every morning in my a rickshaw person would come and pick mm-hmm. me up and take me to school, and I would have my favorite places where I would get my Chinese little dumplings on the street, you know, mm-hmm. like you would over here with Frankfurters mm-hmm. and pizza. I had my little places that I've gotten.
It's written about you that your interest in art came first from the Buddhist monks in China, is that true?
Right where I used to live, one of the places before the Japanese occupation, we lived in this fabulous place. It was a villa that my father bought very inexpensively because he were from Europe, you know, mm-hmm. with a little money, but it was a lot of money there. And he bought this fabulous villa where little Peter can run around and be on his bicycle. I still remember him telling me the stories. But right across mm-hmm. the fence from where we lived was a Buddhist monastery where I had my first touch with Eastern philosophy. Mm-hmm. And there were these artists, probably martial artists, who used to do brush paintings on the floor. Yeah. And it used to fascinate me how they used to take these big brushes and they just used to like wipe these brushes around and draw these mm-hmm. fabulous things on the floor, you know, just with four strokes, a bird this big. But I didn't get involved in it yet. The chanting and the incense that used to come every day when mm-hmm. the wind was right into my house. And then when we moved, there was another house, and that house was across the street from a Hindu a sheikh, you know, the sheikhs that wear the turbans, a Hindu temple. So again, the incense and the prayer all day while I was sleeping, and at 5 in the morning used to come into my life. So there's a lot of, you know, cultural training that came sort of in my sleep.
It's a tremendous cultural leap, it seems to me, from Shanghai to Africa to Israel to Brooklyn and to Madison Avenue. But it's a leap you made. Brooklyn through the Pratt Institute
mostly the Art Students League.
Art Students League. And fairly quickly, you were into Madison Avenue, weren't you?
Yeah.
And into a firm, a partnership where you did graphics.
I came out of art school and worked for a fairly famous art studio in town for a few weeks. And then I opened my own art studio and got involved in Madison Avenue again at a very nice place, because here I was dealing with not one agency but with 100 mm-hmm. because I was a design studio, freelancing graphics. So I learned all about media and all about public relations and advertising and budgets and corporations, all through that.
And you did very well. You won quite a few awards, as I recall, in the first 2 years of doing this.
What was the
magic that made it so successful commercially?
Again, I think what it was that I have that little English in my life from the Orient that makes my graphic presentation a little different. In other words, somebody wants it, and I have just all this background that's Eastern. But it's still Eastern and digested with my Western background and having been born in Berlin, Germany, and my mm-hmm. parents who come from big cities, you know, and having lived in Berlin, in Shanghai, and Paris, and mm-hmm. the big cities of the world. And now being here, it manifests itself in some other ways.
It fuses itself in whatever it is you do.
In fact, when I was in Madison Avenue and I had won over 80 awards and won in about an 18-month period, I was amazed and I was confused. How come me, all my friends, my buddies I went to school with, were still...
You were amazed.
I was amazed. I didn't understand it. I knew this stuff was good, but I thought all my other people that I worked with were good too. But somehow it pulled away. It was different when I thought it was part of a group. So later
You pulled away. Pulled out of that firm, didn't you?
Yes, I pulled away, then I went into retreat, and I painted for 2 years.
Why did you pull away and go into retreat?
Well, I had enough commercial art for a while, this Madison Avenue art, and then after 2 years, I've painted, and I created this style that I sort of brought in from the skies and put it down into the streets, you know, the cosmic jumper who felt himself everywhere on this planet.
And what did you do in those 2 years in retreat?
In those 2 years, I just played. You know, I would get up at 4 in the morning and I would be at my easel in my underwear painting and having breakfast at 10 and then showering and shaving at the time and doing my thing. I just worked all
the output never dried up.
Never. I produced many thousands of pieces of work. Then that period, you know, it manifested itself into the corporate level, rather through advertising directly with the corporations, and that went on for about 2-3 years. And now for the last year and a half, again, I've dropped out. Mm-hmm. I've given up all commercial involvement.
You have given it up.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just involved in things that interest me in a super artistic way. I paint all day long on my canvases. Mm-hmm. And when a project like Times Square comes that I really feel is an artistic project, I'm not an architect, I'm not a consultant, I'm just an innovator in taking something that's there, that's a monument, and turning it into something that's really fabulous to my mm-hmm. mind. So that and painting all day is how I occupy my whole day. Mm-hmm.
As an innovator or someone who has this power you spoke of earlier, you apparently have you're not troubled with doubts about whether it's the right thing or not.
No,
you move ahead.
No, there's mm-hmm. a certain place in me that when I move forward and the joys mm-hmm. Within is felt, it feels right.
So the doubt would be a barrier if you permitted
yeah.
it to...
Yeah, if it feels wrong, then it would... there's no doubt, if mm-hmm. it's a joyous feeling, I just move ahead. And it's half the work is creating, stimulating others to work, and the other half is exciting the other people around to like, let's go and do it.
You must do more than that to excite other people around you. It isn't like a cheerleader, I'm sure.
No, but they see, you know, how gung-ho I am on a project now. Mm. Just pull out all stops and I pull the canvases and I bring in friends of mine who are in audiovisual and I just create a whole... And then it's there and everybody rejoices in it and suddenly a project is born. You can see everybody in the room is full of excitement and something is going to happen.
Mm. I'd like to take a look at what it is you're doing now. Because it is quite a departure from what you've done for commercial yeah. art. What you're doing now is, if I understand you correctly, really fine art. Is that right?
Well, it's always fine art from where I stand.
I mean, it hasn't the utilitarian value yeah. of advertising and that kind
yes.
of thing.
Yes, what these things are, they are paintings on canvas, but really what they are just little studies. Mm-hmm. I'll pull out a canvas, put it on the easel and paint for it in half an hour or two and create something like that. Or some of the others. Not just paint on them. The paint flows, you know. The greasy substance, which is oil or acrylic, merge in front of my eyes, and my intuitions of picking up red or green or blue happen. Mm-hmm. And a painting occurs right in front of my own eye. This painting you're looking at wasn't pre-planned. That green and that gray blending to
it
white.
Happens in a
happened.
Sense.
I did not know that they could have been leaves of a vase. This happens afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I let it just occur. All I know, there's a joyous moment. The paints feel right. The mood is right. Mm-hmm. And I continue. And then as it comes together and it feels like a vase with flowers, then I sort of try to put my paints, my brushes into the water and walk away. Because mm-hmm. once it feels, it is. So I don't want to over-labor it, and somehow it's just come out.
Mm-hmm. While we're looking at this last picture, let me ask you your thoughts on several things, the first of which is money, which you've apparently earned a great deal of through commercial mm-hmm. art. Do you feel that you have the security now with money that you can do the kind of thing you're doing now, or is money still involved?
Well, money is energy.
It is energy.
And it means that one day money meant buying paints, and so another day, money means buying groups mm-hmm. and think tanks and working with sophisticated research teams in making my project more real. In other words, I have ideas sometimes, like for instance now, where 3 years ago, I definitely thought as much as I've caused things, you know, out there, you know, with the Peter Max name, mm-hmm. whatever that happened, as much as that happened, there were still ideas I said, Jesus, never in my life will this ever happen. It's too far-fetched.
Yeah.
And today already, just 2-3 years later, even these ideas are becoming real. It gives me a tremendous amount of adrenaline and excitement.
But money has been a power in making.
Well, comes in larger quantities, there's larger projects.
Of course, it's the energy.
So it's always, it's the energy.
You don't take it for granted then?
No, I tell you, I have a lot of respect for it. I live a very frugal life. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't run around much, and you know, it's...
You enjoy spending it not on personal things, then?
Not really. I'd like to give, you know, myself or my family the comfort, you see, and the rest is just the personal environment which gives me the right creative output, you know, gives me the right creative place mentally. But the rest is that if I do have an idea and I want to build a city from Massachusetts to Florida, if that's my idea, Meganopolis, that stretches 3,000 or 2,000 miles long, encased in 1,000 pyramids, whatever, you know, in one straight line. If I have this idea to be able to hire the right model makers to take these ideas that I sketch out and build it for me and make this a reality, so when I bring an Abe Beam or a Lindsay or someone from the federal administration down and say, this is my latest creation, it's not just standing there and saying, geez, a creative artist and look at these wonderful ideas, but there it is. Not only is it on a table in three-dimensional and you can lift off the chunks and see how they live inside, but there'll be statistics with it. There'll be, you know, analysis. Because if I'm dealing not with graphics, but I'm dealing with civic and federal things, my media, you know, my brushstrokes have to be that thorough that they understood.
Your media is me, so to speak, isn't it?
Yes.
All of us.
Right.
You mentioned your family, Peter. You do have two children, and their names would suggest to me an interest in astrology as well.
Well, I named them during the period 9 years ago when Adam was born and Libra, she's seven. And I was at that time going through my heaviest cosmic period.
I see.
It's the period
what,
when...
What is a heavy cosmic
period? A heavy cosmic period is a time in my life when I was interested in swamis and I wanted to know, what is it all about? I mean, why am I here? What is this? Why do I get up in the morning feeling happy or sad? Why? The big why that nobody knows. And then I finally found a great Swami who at least gave me the notions that through him and his examples and some of the studies, I might find out why for myself. And I found out why, and I find out now, and it's just multiplied my scope of what life and world is all about to understanding that this little thing here, you know, however little and however great, you know, the micro and the, you know, macroism of it is an expression of God, who I am. You are. We all are
we
God.
All are.
See? So we can call ourselves God, knowing, of course, that we are just that aspect. Like these things can all call each other fingers. We are all, I am the pinky. But this pinky knows he's part of a hand. Therefore, you know, I am an individual aspect. One of, when they speak about God, you say, God is multifaceted, omnipresent, omnipotent, you know. What are the omnis, you know? We are, everyone are these omnis, the doctors, the scientists, the joyous ones, the suffering ones, the ones that are alive, the ones who die, the ones who are great and the ones who are sad. All of us are experiencing life for God's sake, you see? And then all his notions and intuitions of God, which we are, it's not really his, it's like, myself, my intuition is that aspect. It's that growth.
Peter, what about fame? You've got considerable fame. Some people say that you will one day be at least as famous as Walt Disney and Norman Rockwell, which I find a bit amusing because among young people they'll say, who's Norman Rockwell? And they certainly know Peter Max. Is fame important to you at all?
Well, there's two things. Fame, now I'm starting to understand what fame is. Fame is that many people recognize you and they sort of, when you walk into a room, there's an attitude which sometimes can be hard.
Because it's inhibiting rather than
it's inhibiting because if I walk into a room, I'm not thinking about myself being famous. It's just Peter, you know. Peter humbly walking out of an elevator with a friend, wanting to maybe share some time, but the people are all prepared for something, you know, different. So learning how to deal with that has become another way of life, which occurs occasionally. The other thing is fame and game. Go hand in hand.
Fame and game.
Fame and game. Certain things are for fame, and certain things are for game.
I see.
The fame, I guess, is just what is the repercussion, the echo of what one does. It comes back, and if it's really right and touches a lot of souls, it becomes fame. The game is what one really does for humanity. In my case, it's for humanity, for somebody could be...
There is a purpose behind
all
this.
There is a purpose. I would like to build cities. I would like to show comfort to people. I would like to reduce suffering of mankind. This, if I searched my deepest points, I would say everything starts and begins with that. in reducing the suffering, in educating the naive, and bringing, you know, some spirituality through our modern means, through this television set, through the radios, through the media, through cups and mugs, through bed sheets, whatever. They are all media. They all expose concepts. So when I even took all my drawings that I did and put them on bed sheets, you know, so many people would confuse and say it was such a commercial thing. Of course, there was a commercial thing involved in order for me to even be able to get the bed sheets. And I thought about the money probably at the least. Mm-hmm. I just wanted those big prints on giant sheets.
It was the means.
Yeah,
it was the media.
So a 9-year-old boy who goes to sleep on a sheet on Star or something has a notion of something futuristic. Mm-hmm. It's like while we're living here on this planet, here and now, this very right now, some people are living in the future. I consider I'm in a planet of the future.
You are.
I live in it, I dream of it, I think of it, I eat for that purpose, I just do futuristic things. And other people are still living in the past. Mm. So the future and the past are all here.
You've said at some time in the past, the world's mood is right for my style. So you're not concerned about the fact that moods are ephemeral, that moods will change. If you're working in the future, you feel that your style will never go out of style, so to speak. Is that right?
It's as though, you know, that there is a capsule somewhere in space, in an astral plane, in someplace beautiful, according to my imagination. And I'm taking from that and I'm bringing it out here. So I'm futuristic in my thoughts. And I've learned timing living here. Mm-hmm. I've learned timing of how to bring it in, how to bring these concepts in and make them work. And that's why sometimes the commercialness comes in, which is confusing to people who really do not know what my motives are. You see, oh, it's commercial, capitalism, and so on and so. But that's secondary. It's just a means of getting this stuff out.
Thank you very much, Peter Max.
You're welcome.